Okay, welcome back for week two, everybody, to the Future Lab. So last week we did sort of an introduction overview on kind of logistics and introduction of the Future Lab, a lot of team building work, and getting prepared to start to dive into the content here. This week we'll be jumping into a first in a couple weeks of a speaker series that we'll be doing. We'll be introducing you to experts from a fairly diverse set of backgrounds, everything from sort of urban planning and history and society and even some stuff sort of outside the purview of what we'll be studying here in the Future Lab. So this week especially, we have Ella Howard from Wentworth, who some of you may have already had at your time at the Institute, who will be kicking us off this morning. This afternoon we'll potentially hopefully have Reverend Evan Hines joining us with Dave Marrera also, who's from Wentworth but is intimately connected to the community, and will be a great sort of person to pair Reverend Hines with this afternoon. We also have coming up tomorrow, we have Inez von Wietershausen, I hope I got that right, from MIT. And Greg Friedman from PARXL / Foundation Medicine. So both of those individuals will be diving a little bit deeper into sort of the future of work and what that could look like. Thursday, we'll be closing out the speakers for the week with Larry Chan, who some of you folks may also be familiar with, as well as Tom Van Armen. So both of them will be discussing sort of future considerations for cities. And then we'll close out the week with Crit reviewing kind of what you researched and pulled up from the week. So with that, I can hand it off to Ella, if you'd like to kick off.
Awesome, thank you. So I'm gonna try to share my screen, which you have disabled. Would you like to undisable that feature so that I can show my slides?
All set, should be good to go.
Okay, let me try again. Better, okay, awesome, thank you. So thank you so much for this invitation. Thanks to Monique and Greg and everybody who's put this together. I'm excited to be here to talk to you today. I see some familiar names in the student group. So for those of you who've had me before, hi, I hope it's not like your worst nightmare that I'm back. For those of you who have had my classes, some of this will definitely be a review because I took very seriously this opportunity to present our own individual perspectives on this pandemic. So I come to you here in my role as a historian, but particularly as an urban historian. And of course, even within that subset, we all have our own particular interests. So I'll talk to you a little bit about how I see some of the work in my field relating to what's been going on. So I wanted to start off, and this will be a very informal talk, and I also will be happy to provide these slides. I'll send them over to Monique and Greg at the end of this presentation so that any references here that you'd like to follow up on, you can. I wanted to frame this in the context of this really sobering front page from the New York Times that we saw on Sunday. I trust that some of you may have seen this as well and some of the controversy around it. All the data nerds are out in full force to fight about what this means and what it doesn't mean. So here they put together brief obituary statements, just a phrase, for instance, capturing what some might sum up someone's life, and they presented us with 1,000 of these cases. But of course, as the death toll here in the United States gets close to 100,000, and I haven't checked for today, we realize the scale, right? The incalculable loss that the Times is talking about here. And then we want to situate that even more broadly. Of course, we're thinking about what is a global crisis. I am sometimes surprised that the American media has moved on from what's going on in other countries, but that is a really a shortcoming of American media. We tend to lose sight of what's going on in Europe or Asia or Africa when it doesn't press on us directly. But globally, of course, just like here in the United States, this is a health crisis, right? And it's also a financial crisis. And that's where you could get into a lot of the partisan political fighting about this. I do a lot of political history, and that will be a major takeaway we'll be looking at in the future, right? Was this primarily a health crisis, a financial crisis, both? How do we see the emphasis there? But for our purposes today, and for your purposes here in this Future Lab, I think one thing to reflect on is that we keep hearing all of these ads and all of these speakers, and everyone keeps telling us these are unprecedented times. And that's certainly true. But as a historian, of course, that means that I still think that we can draw on the lessons of the past. So just because this exact scenario hasn't played out before doesn't mean that we can't learn from things that have happened. And then thinking specifically, right, I know a lot of architecture students are wrestling with these questions, and you're asking these really vital key questions going forward. What is this going to mean? So you may be familiar with this piece recently from The Guardian, this series of articles where Oliver Wainwright is looking at some of these questions from an architecture perspective. So the title here, the headline really captured my attention, Smart Lifts. These would be obviously elevators that you could call on your phone so you wouldn't have to push the button. Lonely workers, right? No tourists. What is architecture going to be like after the coronavirus? And one image from this article that really struck me is this plan for an office building. And in the Q&A, if we have time, I would love to hear from some of the students and architects to weigh in on how you see this piece as possibly responding to what's going on. I can tell you that what they framed it as in the piece is that this would be a contactless surface, right? The staircases are designed that you never have to grab that handrail, right? You can keep your hands to yourself as you move through this open space. But obviously, it also harkens back to that sense of cleanliness that we associate with the mid-century designs that were responding to previous situations of contagion and disease. So again, there are touchstones that we look back to, even as we look forward. So what are some of the key themes then, as we sit here at this moment, this unprecedented, pretty horrible moment in a lot of ways, and we look around? We know that everywhere you look, everyone's talking about social distancing, right? We're fighting about what that means, how far is far enough, how long will this last? Contactless surfaces seems to be a really key distinction coming up, particularly in a lot of the design fields. This question of individualized office spaces. So I'm excited that you'll be looking at the workplace because I think that's obviously something that we're thinking about a lot. What does it mean to work from home? How does that relate to the transit system, right? So if we all go back to work on campus, let's say in September, if the whole city of Boston goes back to work, but no one feels comfortable riding the T or getting on the Keolis commuter rail and everybody decides to drive, what does that mean for traffic, right? These are very basic kinds of questions, but they're, I think, very real. So to my mind, this isn't a time when we have to go to our high level of critical theory. We can think from some really kind of ground level up practical questions that are facing all of us in the day to day and use those to guide some of our research and our work. Similarly, what will this mean for suburban sprawl? Right? There's a whole celebration of having a back deck in a yard, and that certainly does look better than ever. These days, I don't have any outdoor space where I live in Salem, and I'm very jealous of my friends that have the big yard in the suburbs. But what does that mean for your commute, right? So what could any of this mean if we don't know what the future is going to hold for us? Walkable cities. There's a lot of literature out there on both sides of this. Will this mean the revival of the walkable city, or is everyone going to move out to the burbs? Right? So people are kind of getting back on their hobby horses. Not surprisingly, if people had a strong opinion about these issues before, they're looking through this crisis as a lens to bring back their argument and make their fight. Urban density is a huge theme for us all to consider. And I wanted to show you this tweet if you hadn't seen it already. Fairly shocking tweet from Governor Cuomo in New York State, where he said that this is not life as usual. And he's talking about the density in New York, and he says it has to stop. And on the one hand, that makes lots of sense. But I lived in New York for a long time, for 13 years, and density is exactly what makes New York City work, right? It is the reason why that city exists. It's been the case since the late 19th century. And what would New York City be without a high level of density? Would it be the city that never sleeps? Would it be appealing at all? And then how does that relate to Boston, right, where we're focused? Can we see Boston at lower density? And if so, where? How? How would we approach that? Who would make those decisions? And then finally, and this is the piece where I think my own research comes in as a bias here, not necessarily a negative bias, just my own perspective. We see a lot of discussion lately, if you follow Governor Baker and Mayor Walsh and these types of presentations, they're giving us a lot of data about the disparate health outcomes by neighborhood. So we know that there is not one Boston. Those of you who've taken my Boston history class know I always emphasize that there are many Bostons. And I think that's never been more true than now, as we look around and we realize, why are death rates, right, and complications so high in some neighborhoods and other neighborhoods much lower? Why are some communities touched so deeply and other communities less so? What is this crisis revealing about the existing inequality that was always there, right? It's not that we didn't know about it, but now that it's been brought into high relief, what are we going to do about it? Will this spur us to action to make some of those differences a little bit less dramatic, or won't it? And that's where I'll leave you to your own opinion. Those of you who've had me know I can be a bit cynical. So this is probably not the best year for me to try to do a pep talk, but we still have hope that people may learn from what we're seeing these days. So I wanted to emphasize for you then the value of historical thinking as we frame our work around this crisis, right? My whole role at Wentworth is basically banging this drum, so trying to encourage people to value history. But I mean it quite sincerely. I think when we look back to the past, we can do better work as we prepare for the current and for the future. We can learn from past failures. We can see examples of innovation that were successful. We can also think about, what are our analytical frameworks? What are we even trying to study? How will we study? And what would success look like, right? We can develop some metrics so that we can measure our future success. And all of that can be found in the past. So today, what I wanted to talk to you about quite briefly is just sort of a glib overview. Past pandemics. So we'll think about just a couple examples of disease and how they've affected our life and our thinking about design, architecture, urban space. A couple examples of reform, really with a focus on Jacob Riis, always my favorite urban reformer to think about. And then a little bit also about the evolution of the divided city. So how did we get where we are? My pet peeve is really when people say, and this isn't limited to students, people all around us say it, right? It's just the way things are. So if I ask, well, why is our city so divided? That's just the way it is. You'll hear this a lot. And that is such an unsatisfying and frustrating answer, right? Everything that we see around us today is the product and result of a million individual decisions that happened in the past. And only by understanding those decisions can we figure out how to change what's going on. So everything around us was never inevitable. There are a million other paths we could have gone down. And that, I think that that knowledge, even though it can be a bit overwhelming, is helpful as we look forward. And then finally, at the end, I have some resources that I put together, just some brief links to share with you in case you decide to pursue some of these topics more fully. So first, to turn our attention to some of the past pandemics. One that I wanted to emphasize for you is the cholera epidemic, which was an outbreak in London. And I show you here John Snow. He's known as the father of epidemiology. He is of particular interest to people who make maps and who do data analysis, and also people who study public health. He really is the founder of the study of urban public health as we know it today. So he was an obstetrician, and he saw cholera, which had been in England, actively killing people since 1831. And from looking at it, he believed that cholera was spread through water. So he believed sewage contamination was the problem, right? That was why people were suffering and dying. He published this theory in 1849, but people didn't want to hear it. Officials at that time rejected his theory of water contamination. Instead, they said it was vapors. It was all in the air. It was these miasmas that you could smell in the air. And remember, this is before that there was indoor plumbing. So people didn't have running water. So to get water, they would go outside and visit the local pump. In 1854, there was a major outbreak of cholera in Soho, which is a suburb of London. And he looks at that data and he puts it on a geographical grid. So he makes a map, right? An analytical map. And when he does that, he realizes that in 10 days, there were 500 cases in this really small area of Soho. And he felt that this bolstered his argument that these were tied to a water supply. And he suspected it was what was known as the Broad Street pump. This was a very popular place to get your water because it tasted better than a lot of the other water in the city, which is just disgusting, right? When we think about that, the fact that you could taste the difference. So he did the research and he also proved the counter argument. So he found some people who didn't get sick, who were near the pump, but he found out those were, for instance, the brewery workers who were drinking the beer instead of the water. So that was why they weren't ill. Then he found a couple of women outside the area who did get sick in that outbreak. And he said, well, why would they be sick? And he looked into it and it turned out one of those women had lived near the Broad Street pump and the water there was so good, she actually had it delivered, pumped and brought to her. So unfortunately, she got her water delivery and served it to her niece. And within a day, they were both dead. So as they do further investigation, people still don't want to hear it. They don't listen to him. There was a reverend who was convinced that this was just an act of God. God was striking people down. It had nothing to do with water. So the reverend tried to counter-prove this point, right? Tried to disprove John Snow's argument. But in his investigations, he actually uncovered the smoking gun. And I'm sorry to tell you this before lunch if you're not familiar with this story, but it was a woman whose baby had cholera and she had washed the baby's cloth diaper and then taken that wash water and dumped it into a cesspool that leached into the Broad Street pump. So that was what had sickened and ultimately killed so many people. So we hear this and we might think, well, that's really disgusting. Thanks for sharing that, right? But we also forget sometimes that clean water is such a luxury. And you don't forget that if you've done any work on Flint, Michigan, and thought about access to water, even here in this country. But I'd also ask you to keep in mind that in developing nations, according to recent data, as much as 78% of people in developing nations don't have access to clean water even today. So the scale of public health and how it can shape design is really quite broad, right? And can affect so much about our urban planning. Thinking more locally, here in the United States, what you've probably been hearing about recently would be the Spanish flu. Right, the 1918 pandemic. We see this a lot on CNN and shows like that. They're always drawing these parallels. So I show you here an infographic from the CDC that the CDC quite ironically put out as a like a triumphal celebration of their 100-year anniversary of the 1918 pandemic. So there's a lot of their media that came out in 2018, just prior to COVID-19. And I'd like to show you just this brief, it's like 1 minute video piece. I'm not sure if you'll hear the sound, but it doesn't really matter. It's just some instrumental music playing over some text and historical images. It's about a minute long. So when we think about this 1918 pandemic, just a couple of points that I wanted to highlight for you. Approximately one third of the world was ultimately infected by the flu. And I, even as a historian, I hadn't realized that it was that high a number. The death count in the United States was 675,000. And that's a number that I've heard before as a historian, but it has new meaning, right? In the context of now we're talking about 100,000. So there were 675,000 Americans die, 50 million people globally. So this is the reason why people often hearken back to the 1918 pandemic. One takeaway. So I looked at what do historians say about this who study this more. They say the big takeaway is that it was forgotten. As soon as this happened, as soon as we could move on, people moved on. So if you think about after World War I, this country moves into the roaring 20s and you're picturing the Great Gatsby, right? We're not thinking and dwelling on this public health crisis of an unimaginable scale. And I will say the most frightening point that I read from a historian of public health about this was that at that time, our world, like the whole earth basically, was far less densely populated. They say now there are about four times as many people worldwide than there were on this planet in 1918, which, I mean, obviously, when we're talking about social distancing and contagion, that's a number that really gave me pause. Another disease that we think about a lot in the 19th and 20th century is tuberculosis. And when we think about how TB was spread, this is from the CDC, you can see that when a person breathes in the bacteria, it fosters in your lungs, but from there it can also move to other parts of the body, such as the kidney, the spine, and the brain. And that was also new to me. I'm not an expert in disease, so I didn't realize that in many ways it does parallel some of what we've been seeing with COVID-19. From a design perspective, in terms of architecture and social planning, remember that this leads to the establishment of those sanatoriums, right, from the mid-19th century onward as a place for people to go. So we would just get them out of the city and put them in institutions. It's that era of institution building that we always talk about, asylums and sanatoriums for people who needed long-term health isolation. More aesthetically, right, we can remember that some historians tie a lot of the trends of modernist architecture to this subsequent desire for fresh air, sunlight. They say that's why the flat roof, the garden terrace, balconies, these are all ways for us to get fresh air and light. So what about reform, right? We've seen some very dire things. I don't want to leave you on this note. How can we make a difference? What are examples of people who have made a difference in terms of architecture and urban planning? Well, remember in the late 19th century, we have the massive inflow of immigrants coming to this country, that first and second wave of immigration. The population of places like Boston and New York will increase dramatically, right? So I gave you a couple of numbers here. New York by 1860 is up to over 800,000 people, whereas in 1820, there had been just over 100,000. And they're gonna pack those people into apartments, these tenement apartments. First, they're gonna divide up the existing buildings for profit so that the landlords can make some money. And then they're gonna start building buildings to accommodate these arriving immigrants. Remember that in New York City, the gridiron city plan meant that the lots were 25 feet across and 100 feet deep. So when we think about density, we're thinking about the percentage of that lot that's covered with architecture versus how much is open space. So a lot of these are railroad flats, like cars on a train, right? One room right after the other. The area was incredibly dense. It was overbuilt. And this led to a lot of problems, not only with airflow and disease, but also just fire, right? A very basic public health concern. So I show you here on New York City housing before 1879, just to give you a sense of what some of these dwelling houses looked like in terms of coverage of the lot. So you'll see in those early designs, the early floor plans, you see the yard space, and that yard is going to get smaller and smaller as the buildings get bigger to maximize profit. So into our story comes Jacob Riis, the reformer of choice. So he is a newspaper reporter and a photographer. He's born in Denmark in 1849, comes to the United States when he's a young man, 21 years old. He comes because of a broken engagement. The young woman that he was in love with, her father didn't think that little Jacob, young Jacob, was good enough for his little girl. So he comes to the United States. And he gets the police beat, the crime beat. So he goes all over New York City to the worst neighborhoods, right? Places where the worst things happen. And he sees a lot of things that open his eyes. He's also a pioneer of flash photography. So this is when they're first able to take these types of photos inside homes that are not well lit. So they would burst in the door and fire off a flash gun, which actually looked like a gun. So that's why a lot of people in his photos look kind of surprised. It's because someone just burst into their apartment and shot them with a flash gun. He publishes his findings in 1890 in a book called How the Other Half Lives. And if you haven't looked at it, I always recommend it. It's very dated. It's very racist in places. There's all the things that you would expect from the 19th century. But there's also some really interesting observations and particularly powerful photographs. So he publishes this book as a way to make the wealthier people aware of how the poor were living. So the poor were the other half. So I wanted to show you just a few of his photos that he took of New York City. This is an 1890 cityscape, one of my favorite of his photos. I think it really captures the disorder the chaos, the filth, the contagion, right? How closely packed in the density that we were looking at. Because as dense as New York City is today, remember, it was more densely populated in the late 19th century than it is today. So an apartment that now you might share with, you know, one person, there would be like a family of 12 or two families of 12 living in that apartment. Life for the poor in the urban city was pretty rough. This is a picture from Poverty Gap, which is contemporary Chelsea, if you're familiar with New York City, over by like 23rd or 25th Street on the west side. Here you can see they had very limited playground equipment and a lot of dirt. His most famous photograph that you'll see reproduced on postcards and bags and things like that, street Arabs in their sleeping quarters. Often these are kids who were homeless, who would sell things to get by. Historians always remind us, those kids are probably not sleeping, which any parent who's ever taken my class usually raises their hand to point that out. So they're like, that kid on the left, he's totally faking it. And historians agree. They think that Jacob Riis found these kids who were really homeless, but just said, hey, show me how you sleep, and took the picture. My personal favorite teacher in condemned Essex Market School. You can get a sense of density. Also the gas jets, right? The open flames up above them, providing light and heat. So you really get a feeling from his work of what these interior spaces were like. He wasn't a great portraitist, but every now and then he would do a good job capturing something of the essence of someone's personality, as he does in this photo. This family in Poverty Gap picture also, I think, gives us a real sense of what it might be like to live in one of these spaces at that level of density. Just in terms of hygiene and contagion, you don't see a lot of light and air, right? They have the one oil lamp. There's a broom, and I'm not trying to blame the family. I'm sure they did the best they could with that broom, but your opportunities for real cleanliness and hygiene were just extremely limited in this environment. So by publishing his book and getting the word out there, getting people aware of what was going on, he helped to join the chorus of people who were pushing in New York City and New York State for tenement reform laws. So they start by 1879, shifting that floor plan of the buildings, right, so that you're looking at the footprint being much more narrow. They start to put in these air shafts. And then finally, you'll see the new law tenements, which have a much more significant integration of open space there so that you can have more light, more air. And if you study the history of the design of apartments in New York, you know that from there the story goes maybe toward the garden apartments and things like that out in Queens, when people start moving out to those near suburbs to get exactly that, more air, more light, more space. So I wanted to share that with you as one example of a time when someone took seriously these questions of public health and density and was able to lobby for, at that time, the laws that needed to be put in place to make this possible. Because at that time, the free market economy was not going to do this, because the profit to be made from packing people into those buildings as densely as you could was just too tempting. So I wanted to survey briefly as well for you a little bit about how we got where we are in terms of being a city so divided. We know that certain neighborhoods carry certain demographics, right? There are parts of New York and parts of Boston that are extremely segregated by race and class. So often when we say the word segregated, people think you mean the South. But actually, hyper-segregated cities most often occur in the North, right? Quite often, places like Chicago, New York, Boston. And when we talk about segregation, it's not just by race, but it's also by class, right? So we want to think about how those intersect. Socioeconomic segregation and how that ties in with racial segregation. So this is a lot of what my work deals with. I think in the bio that I sent you, you may have seen, I study poverty and I'm currently studying gentrification and how these fit together. So the big five pieces that I would encourage you to keep in mind when we think about why our cities are the way they are these five places where we also have government involvement, right? So these are not free market forces on their own, whatever we might take that to mean. These are all cases where government incentives have been put in place to create the cities that we have today? So to that end, we can ask the question, does that mean that there is no hope that government could ever create a different future? Or does it mean that, there is? That does it mean that those incentives can be quite powerful? So I just wanted to talk to you briefly about what these terms mean if you're not as familiar with them. Redlining refers to the policies that were put forward by the federal government in response to the Great Depression. So one of the first New Deal efforts to reform housing, they wanted to make sure people could keep their mortgage. And then they wanted to figure out where the banks should loan their money to. So in 1933, the Homeowners Loan Corporation was formed. And they came out and they did studies of over 200 different cities across the country. And they put out these maps where they rated each neighborhood for lending stability. Now, historians don't know how widely the maps were circulated. That part we don't know. We don't know if they got in the hands of every mortgage officer. But we do know that the perceptions shaped a lot of what people felt about these neighborhoods in terms of investment. We do know that these maps unfortunately track pretty closely with the disinvestment that went on in these neighborhoods for decades. And perhaps most usefully, for historians at least, like why I like these maps, is they are a really accurate picture of how the neighborhoods broke down by race and class. And that's coming in at a period before you can get that type of data aggregation from the census. So you can look at these maps and see who lived where, why, right? Why were they rated this way? The part about this that you may have heard, they didn't tend to rate the neighborhoods based on the quality of the housing stock. So very rarely did they make these determinations as to how to rank the neighborhoods based on architecture. They made it based on the people, right? So they straight up write on the form, you know, if it was the race, right? They would say there were too many Negroes, there were too many Jews, there were too many Italians, too many immigrants. And the form even says like infiltrating force, that that was the federal form that the local committee would fill out. So it was a very blatant type of racism. It's not like the kind of thing you're going to look at these forms and say, oh, Professor Howard, she thinks everybody's a racist. This is the kind of thing that you look at. And most students say, wow, that's pretty clear, right? The way they ranked the neighborhoods, green was good. Green was the letter A, lend these people money, fabulous. And it went down from there till you got to red. So red tended to be the neighborhoods where there were the most immigrants, most African Americans, the most Jewish residents. And that's the neighborhoods they said, please don't lend money here. This is a bad risk. You'll lose your money. So that's the first piece that you might be interested in. And one of the resources that I offer at the end for you is a website where you can log in and you can look at these maps all from all over the country. They're pretty interesting. Another question, what about public housing? That definitely groups people into neighborhoods by class, by definition, right? Public housing emerges at the same time as a way to provide decent housing for the poor, to get them out of those slummy tenements into a nice place with running water, right, windows. And at first they were very desirable, but over time, the upkeep and the maintenance is definitely gonna slide in a lot of these housing developments. They will also be intentionally racially divisive. And in terms of Boston history, we're actually one of the most shocking examples of that. It's really into the 1980s when the NAACP brings a lawsuit. Does Boston Housing Authority agree to try to diversify some of the demographics of their housing projects? But remember here, right, even just segregation by class, if you push the poorest people into a neighborhood, what does that mean when you have a global health pandemic, right? People with big families, small apartments, lower employment opportunities, less money, worse health insurance, less likely to go and get tested, maybe less likely to get a vaccine if one emerges. You can see the pretty dire consequences we might face. We also just want to keep in mind that part of how we got here was urban renewal, right? This federal program tied to slum clearance, where we could see a way to redevelop some of these desirable downtown areas for mixed use developments by pushing those working class populations out of those neighborhoods, often into public housing, to be honest. So those changed the demographics of the downtown and helped contribute to this shaping of people that was pretty deliberate. And then we must also consider suburban growth, as I was talking about at the beginning, right? This post-war expansion after World War II, moving people further and further outside the cities to these bands of suburban developments, ties in to highway development. So those of you considering transit as one of the things you're going to look at this summer, I think this is definitely something to keep in mind. The emerging suburbs that came into play in the post-war period were often racially exclusive, like blatantly so. If you look at the Levitt towns on Long Island, Pennsylvania, these straight up said they had restrictive covenants so that you could not sell your house to a person of color. People of color were allowed to be there only to work basically on the properties, but they couldn't live there. They couldn't own the home. This type of suburban growth led to a lot of what we see now, right? Something of a consumerist society. You get the big house and then you got to go to Pier 1 and buy all the stuff to fill up your house. And what happens if we stop buying those pillows for even 6 weeks? Pier 1 is going bankrupt, right? So it's all pieces that stack and fit on top of each other. Of course, as people of means who could moved out to those suburbs, the inner cities got more and more poor, right? They became more densely populated with minority populations who often had less money, and the tax base slipped, and so did the funding for the public schools. So the families of means who stayed in the cities tended to put their kids into private schools. And that's in the North and the South. The last point I wanted to touch on with you is this question of gentrification, which I think is a current theme of the last 10 years in particular. It's what I'm researching right now. When you see this displacement of residents and businesses by more affluent people, right? So a quote here I wanted to share with you from Spike Lee: why does it take an influx of white New Yorkers in these neighborhoods for the facilities to get better? What about the people who were living there before? So one question I would challenge you to consider as you go forward with your work, think about how do these changing neighborhoods of the last 20 years, right? How is all of this factoring into what we're seeing today and what we might see going forward? How could we create a more equitable urban future? So here you are, you're in this future lab, you have this opportunity, and I just wanted to say how lucky I think you are. I think this is really a great opportunity because you're gonna get the chance to think about breadth and depth. So from what I understand of the schedule, it looks like you're gonna hear from people in a wide range of different fields and then have the opportunity to study more deeply the aspect that calls to you. So that structure is gonna offer you a chance to get this kind of broad survey. It's also gonna give you time and space. And I don't know about you, but my attention span is very low these days. I'm lucky if I can read a short form piece of writing. The crippling anxiety isn't really helping me, but I'm jealous of you having this time and space to read, to analyze, to think about precedents, to bounce your ideas off of each other, to get feedback and input from a diverse range of professionals, not just your faculty, but also people in industry and in the community. So that I think you're gonna be able to come out with some really meaningful work. So just a few resources that I wanted to share with you. If you're interested in any of the topics that I presented today, these are pretty light media pieces, some websites that you can look at just to get you started. But please know as the summer goes on, if you have any questions about any of this or there's any kind of historical angle that I could help you with, I'm happy to do so. Please feel free to reach out to me. So I think I'm on time. If we want to open it up for questions or discussion, or if you want to talk to each other.
We have a question in the chat, Ella, for you. I can read it if you want to check it out.
Let me stop sharing so I can see the chat. Okay, this question from Bradley. If people who rented apartments in these low-income housing units gained credit, would cities be less segregated, or is it that the government that needs to be influenced? So are we thinking here about public housing in particular?
Yes.
That's a really interesting question. So like in the research that I've done, even just about Southie, where there's some pretty famous housing projects, right, that used to be the all white housing projects. When you look at those and you look at the split between the household incomes of the families who live there now, and you look at the housing values in Southie, I don't know. And I think you're getting at, it's a really great question because you're getting at the hardest part of all of this for me, I guess. How do people who earn, let's say you earn minimum wage and you have two parents working and making minimum wage, how do you afford to live in Boston? And I've long felt that this is going to be the greatest question, I think, that's going to sit with your generation, everyone coming out of Wentworth, to wrestle with. I'd love to hear more ideas from you all about that.
I mean, I think that a good credit is definitely important to move on. But at the same time, having a low income with a good credit doesn't really help a lot, because you can get a mortgage, but you cannot pay for it. So I think there is no, like, I think that the income is more important at this point. Because if you have a good income, then you can build a good credit and then pay for your mortgage. So.
But at the same time, if you don't have any credit and you can't get a mortgage on a house that's in a neighborhood that's not low income or close to the city or wherever the work is, then you're not going to be able to get a better income for yourself. Which is why a lot of...
You muted yourself, Brad.
My bad. Which is why a lot of people in the white community have a lot easier job coming from nothing and moving and making something for themselves, whereas a lot of people in the black community have a lot harder time with that.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I mean, if you're interested in how housing discrimination still plays out in ways that you may or may not be surprised by, depending on your own perspective and experience, Newsday out on Long Island had an expose within the past couple of years where they went undercover with a lot of realtors, and it was really dispiriting. I mean, they would come and they would present like the exact same portfolio, right? Two people who want to buy a house, who have the same income, same job, but when the realtor sees that one is black and one is white, they tell you different things and they literally show you different neighborhoods, which now if you spent time on Long Island, maybe that doesn't surprise you, but it's really quite blatant that sometimes even all the money in the world won't get that realtor to show you that neighborhood. And they'll say, oh, you wouldn't be comfortable there. Whose decision should that be, right? Is the consumer really getting all the choices that they're entitled to? Okay, I see another question from Kyle. Is gentrification really the enemy, or is it what we choose to do with improving neighborhoods that determines the positives or negatives? Improving neighborhoods should always be encouraged, but never should we aim to displace people. And I think you put it really well, Kyle. My own research that I'm doing now, where I'm looking at historic preservation and gentrification, like, I gotta tell you, I'm not winning any friends with this talk. When I was applying for jobs, I had some historic preservationists like stand up and like yell at me. And it was hard to explain to them that I'm not anti-historic preservation. I love historic preservation. I'm talking to you right now from a house in a historic district that I adore. But at the same time, I look around my neighborhood and I know that we are not as diverse as we should be, right? In terms of race and class, like that's just what's happened. So even things that are positives for a neighborhood that give us a lot of that value added that helps us preserve walkable cities, if we don't take intentional steps, as you're saying, right, intentional steps to maintain that fabric of the people, we can still lose a lot.
Maybe I can add a comment to that, because I find it really interesting that, especially with many architects in the room, but any profession really, I feel like there's sort of a divide between the different responsibilities and how they affect things. So as I studied architectural preservation, I was in preservation offices for a really long time. For the longest time, it didn't occur to me what the social implications were. I did my job. I was, you know, really, you know, proud of these incredible restorations that were done in certain districts. And the economic impact or the policy impact or the kind of legislature behind it was just not that apparent to the offices I worked in. And also the impact is not so clear. It's not clear to many architects, how can we get involved in this side of things versus just staying in our regular job profile? And I think that's what the opportunity is of this Future Lab, is questioning what are these typical jobs versus where can we fall and maybe impact things or collaborate with people who then write the policies. And I think it's the profession is on a good way to address these things. So it's definitely going in the right direction. But many of us don't feel like we have the power to change things kind of on a social and political level, because the way offices are positioned and the way you get hired for certain things. So I think that's a really important one, like understanding those relationships and impacts, but also trying to put our finger on, so how do we get involved and how do we now kind of get a hook into this by forming teams that maybe include the people who know, or maybe include the people who have to say in that. And a huge question I would have is, for, in terms of research, do these maps that you showed still relate somewhat with COVID-19, with the COVID-19 outbreak? Like, do we, if we overlap now what's happening in some of these neighborhoods, are they still, you know, are they actually still linked in a way? And I bet they are.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in the resources, I link to the mapping inequality site. So if you have a chance, if any of the students want to, you know, click through, what they've done there, they have mapping inequality is all of the work that's been done at the Richmond Digital Lab, and they have all of the federal redlining maps in one place. Now you can look at them. Then they have another website that's called Renewing Inequality, where they pulled all the urban renewal projects and they mapped them on top of the redlining maps, and those correlate shockingly. I think you are going to find cores of disinvestment, right? So if you look at Roxbury, right, if you look at Dorchester, you're going to find areas of Boston that have been historically underinvested in. You'll probably also find exceptions, right? So Jamaica Plain, probably the nation's most famous turnaround in all of these ways, right? A neighborhood that went so rapidly from being extremely diverse, many times low income, working class, people who'd been in the neighborhood for a long time, then massive turnover, huge profits that were made. I mean, this was on like the real estate developers, like cover pages of the magazines, right? As like hottest neighborhoods to get in on. I don't know. Like maybe Jamaica Plain is doing a lot better than one would have thought historically. So I think that's a really good question. Like what's happened in between to change those outcomes?
There's another question in the chat.
Okay, do you think in dense cities like New York that urban housing development will change, or transportation? That's such a good question, right? So I don't know if you saw New York was talking about an idea a couple weeks ago. Could you make a reservation to ride the subway? And people were saying that would absolutely never work. But then somebody else said maybe it would work for commuter rail. So then I'm sitting in my house thinking, am I going to go back to campus? How am I getting back to campus? I don't want to drive with all these people. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe we would make a reservation for Keolis like you do with Amtrak. That actually seems reasonable if they, you know, limit the number of seating. But beyond those ways to modify like passenger use and corporate policies around existing structures, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's a question of resources for one, and political will. Will they have the money? Will they choose to allocate the money toward those types of transportation solutions that it would take? So Kyle says, on the topic of COVID, I wonder what we could expect from gentrified neighborhoods in the post-outbreak city. Will we see disinvestment in neighborhoods due to a possible lack of demand to move into the urban environment? That's an also great question. I mean, you're really having a lot of great thoughts here as we think about places like Boston. So even, I mean, I don't want to be grim, right? I always feel like I'm such a downer, even with my own classes, but here you are kicking off this exciting summer. I'm like, well, but early on with this pandemic, when people were saying, well, what if the college students don't come back to Boston, right? One of my friends on social media, who's an urbanist, said, does that mean that a bunch of other people are going to rush to pay the money for the off-campus housing that we all know students can pay more than a working class family? If the students aren't there, are enough other people going to want to pay $2,400, $3,000 a month for an apartment? I don't know. So then trying to project that further forward, you start getting into like real projections, right? You have to establish what are your assumptions that you're going to use for your scenario, which I think for your summer work, that'll probably be one of the most interesting challenges. What assumptions will you make? Will you assume that at this date, X number of people will be back working in the city in this following way, and then you'll design around that possible reality?
I had a quick question following up on what Anne-Katrin mentioned before in terms of preservation and having your own firm, because that was an interest of a bunch of students, actually, as we learned last week. And so I was wondering, right, what are the ethics around this? Like last week, we've talked a little bit about, you know, knowing what kind of architect or what kind of professional you would like to be in the world. If you are opening your own firm, you know, in particular, or if you're becoming a freelancer, but then if you're not asking those questions as a, you know, working in preservation of what actually happens to the neighborhood. So maybe that would actually get you not the job because you are asking those questions. How do you balance, you know, that ethical dilemma of wanting to do the right thing, but potentially not being able to because you also need some money?
That's a really good question, right? So most of my work is in the past. So the cities that I'm working on for my book, they're really shockingly terrible the way they handle things. So Charleston, South Carolina, if you're familiar with the birth of the preservation movement, is like just, they were just blatantly racist. They push all the African-Americans up out of the historic district in the 1920s. So that's not really surprising. Then in the 1960s, Savannah, Georgia, where I used to live, gets on board with preservation. And there they're doing it also in a moderately racist way, I would say, for Georgia, right? I mean, if you follow politics, partly because they were so appalled that with white flight outside of Savannah, low-income African-Americans were moving into the historic district. And those were the properties that represented the Southern past, the Confederate past to them. And they couldn't bear to see it. And it kind of infects part of their logic, right? So they also were not taking a very nuanced approach. New Orleans actually turned out to be more shocking than I expected. So when I was there last summer doing research in the 1960s, the most famous campaign for historic preservation ever in the country, I guess, right? When they saved the French Quarter, they all just look the other way. The white preservation community looks the other way to save the Vieux-Carré, and they let the Tremé district just get flattened in part for this I-10 that they put in. So if you've been to New Orleans and you've seen that pretty appalling overpass, that's the least popular piece of architecture in the city, it came as a direct result of the trade-off. So they wouldn't run it through the French Quarter. They ran it through the more diverse neighborhood that was also home to a thriving African-American business community. So I think historically, we've seen some really bad decisions, right? There's a lot of much better decisions that go on now, especially since the 1980s. And I would say Boston has done a lot better than they used to. You see examples of different types of community-based projects. The Dudley Square Land Trust is always one I like to talk about with students, where you see them getting a lot of community involvement, community investment, getting money back into the hands of community members, furthering property ownership. And I think to me that has to be a key part of it, right? Is that you do have this push on the part of some firms, some individuals, some city councils to have community participation and mean it, like not just some little charrette where you're going to put up a poster board and say, check that off the list. We got community input, but to actually sit and actually reflect and revise based on community feedback. That's just my perspective as an outsider, though.
So that'll be interesting this afternoon when definitely Dave Marrera is going to join you for an interview, because he's been very active in those community boards and neighborhood associations. And that might be an interesting follow-up. I think it's very timely to grapple with what does equality mean and how do you provide structures and policies around that that are going beyond your actual profession.
Well, maybe one thing to add, and I think a lot of students know this model really well if we stick with the architecture piece, and I could see that happening in other businesses too, is that many firms who did really well at some point started a nonprofit arm that addresses issues that have no clients or that don't come with clients and money, and use some of their overflow funding and then additional grant writing and additional sort of outreach. So public architecture in San Francisco, I think, was a really early one, and there are definitely some in Boston and elsewhere who took on these topics that otherwise sort of fall through the cracks within architecture offices or that they otherwise couldn't get involved in. But it required to get away from the for-profit model. It required different formats. And that's where I think for, you know, you guys who are still in school, looking at your own firm as something maybe that can take on different formats or that is configured slightly differently than the classic version or has different tracks for things that you're interested in is, I think, a really promising model. And it's not that they're not making any money. It's just that they're not maximizing nonprofits or working only with really high-end clients. So I think those might be good examples for us to look at as well. So
great. Well, we are at 12 o'clock. Thank you so much, Ella. This was fascinating, and I love the level of nuance that you bring into the material too. So it was incredibly interesting.
Well, and I wanted to thank everyone for the great discussion. I think we were hitting like PBS level, some WGBH level conversation. That's good.
Thank you so much. Super amount of stuff to think about. And so I think your resources will be highly appreciated. So we'll definitely pull those out. And I have lots of new thoughts for me. So really wonderful. And I hope we can, I know we'll see you in the afternoon, but I hope you'll be back down the road as well with comments and things. So I'll certainly reach out to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.